It's the Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, joining us on this Politics Wednesday. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science and Flansburg Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University in Des Moines. Dennis, in our Des Moines studio, welcome back to you.
Hi, Ben.
Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
Plenty, as always, to chew over, especially with 61 days, if my counting is correct, before the November 8th general election still to come in this hour. I want to ask our analysts, and perhaps you'll have a moment to chime in here with your question or comment. I want to talk about the turmoil at Fox News and how that conservative news network has shaped politics in this country, how both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are courting the labor vote in the week of Labor Day, how surrogates are playing a role in this campaign. But first of all, let's talk a little bit about Congress. Members of Congress returned to Washington this week after a seven-week break. They'll be in a rush to get out the door again to campaign, of course, for their reelection. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, speaking on the Senate floor this morning, began his remarks by striking a note of bipartisanship.
Traveling to our states and meeting with those we represent is one of the best parts of this job. It's also one of the most important. That's because it allows us to hear different perspectives on critical issues and reminds us of the real difference that good policy can make in the lives of the American people. From funding the government to supporting our service members and taking action on issues like Zika, we've got a lot to get done in this upcoming work period. I look forward to working with colleagues on these and other important issues in the coming weeks.
McConnell went on to accuse Democrats of blocking efforts to fund priorities like combating Zika and veterans programs. While on the break, House Speaker Paul Ryan spoke at a luncheon in Milwaukee, claiming House Republicans were more unified than ever in putting forth an agenda. But he also touted work on some bipartisan priorities.
We've made some pretty darn good progress, whether it's trade enforcement legislation, infrastructure legislation, education legislation, the tax bill, which is tax certainty, and combating opioid abuse. So we've gotten some pretty big things done. We've still got a few more big common ground things to do.
Okay. Dennis Goldford, let me turn to you first of all. As they return for these 7 weeks before the election, what does Congress absolutely have to get done?
Well, they're basically killing time from now until their recess for the elections and everything. But, yeah, they've got to make sure we don't have a government shutdown. They've got to get something out in the way of a budget, whether it's a continuing resolution, kick the can into next year, or to try to do something more permanent. Harry Reid supposedly does not want to kick the can. He wants to do something more permanent. He may be looking forward to the thought of a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate together. But first and foremost, they've got to do something about the fiscal side of things.
Mm-hmm. Killing time, is that also the way you'd characterize it, Tim Hagel?
Well, I suppose to a certain extent, yes, although how much they can get done in a short period of time is always questionable. They haven't had a real good track record in terms of getting things done anyway. And, of course, when you've got an election coming right up, they don't want to do anything necessarily that's going to hurt their chances for reelection, both in terms of the individual members, House or Senate, but also in terms of the overall control. So they want to get some things done, at least from the Republican perspective, so that they have that as a positive that they can run on for these last few weeks of the election. But on the other hand, the other party maybe doesn't want them to do so. And so talking about the continuing resolution and how far that's going to stretch out, I'm not sure to the extent to which that Harry Reid really wants to get anything done. I think he's probably more inclined to try to embarrass the Republicans in one way or another as much as possible so that it affects the election results, which mm-hmm. is not surprising. I mean, you know, both sides do that kind of thing, but that's where I think that Harry Reid is probably at right now.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, put us in the shoes of a member of Congress, if you could, less than 10 weeks before this sort of election. How much of that sort of, you mentioned the forecast, possibly the change of the majority in the Senate, less likely, though still a possibility, the change of the majority in the House. Is that on the minds of members of Congress? Are they acting in a different way?
Well, you know, there's an old phrase going back to Great Britain, nothing so wonderfully concentrates the mind as the prospect of being hanged in 15 minutes. Well, for these folks, nothing so wonderfully concentrates the mind as the prospect of having to face the electorate in 9 weeks and counting. So they're very aware of that. One thing that I think in a positive way that is going on the Republican side is that if you think in terms of the what I might call the regular Republicans, sometimes they're called the establishment, as opposed to the so-called Freedom Caucus, the Tea Party folks, and the Trumpers, Ryan and the regular Republicans really are trying to maneuver a way to save the Republican Party, that is, to be seen as a governing party that represents certain specific principles, not all of which they find manifested in the candidacy of Donald Trump. So they are certainly engaged in that kind of activity. But to a great extent, it's just a matter of doing the bare minimum that's necessary to get to the end of the year, and hope all sides hoping that the new Congress will advantage them.
Mm-hmm. Let me run this quote that you mentioned about the possibility of a change of majority in both houses. Let me see to the degree to which either of you agree with this. This is a quote from a Politico article out today. Returning to Washington after their long August recess, Republican lawmakers are cautiously optimistic that GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump can remain disciplined enough over the next 2 months to keep them from getting blown out and give them a fighting chance to hold on the Senate and protect their sizable House majority. Tim Hagel, do you agree with that? If Donald Trump remains disciplined, could this be a much closer race than we've imagined a week or two ago?
I think the short answer is yes, but of course there's a big if in that statement too as to whether he can remain disciplined. I saw parts of his speech that he gave just before the noon hour today, and he was reading from the teleprompter. He wasn't injecting a lot of the side comments that he often did, at least not till the very end of the speech where he sort of loosened up a little bit. But in that respect, that maybe is a little more boring, and maybe some of the Trump's original supporters would like him to be a little more himself, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But for the establishment of regular Republicans, that's what they want to see. They want to see some of that discipline, less of the, sort of really out there kind of Trump comments that have gotten him in trouble before. And that's the kind of thing that then, as Dennis was saying, that the Republicans in the House and the Senate can focus on the policy side of things and maybe not pay quite as attention to Trump, but also not have to defend themselves saying, well, you know, Trump's your party presidential nominee. What do you think about what he said here, what he said there? And so that they don't have to dodge those kinds of questions, and they can focus again on the policy side of things, and hopefully it's to their advantage.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Dennis, about that statement? The if Donald Trump stays disciplined, there's the big question mark there, if we have the teleprompter Trump, as it is often said, or off-the-cuff Trump.
Well, Tim's right. It is a big if. But Kellyanne Conway seems to be doing a good job trying to soften him so far. I mean, we have to remember that we have, as we've said and others have said on the program many times, we have the two most unfavorably viewed candidates of the major parties in over a century. And the big danger for both sides is the voters who simply decide, I can't stand either of them, I'm not going to vote. And of course, that has an impact on down-ballot races starting in Congress. But even if people turn out to vote for congressional races and state-level races and simply not cast a vote for presidency, that's the real wild card. And I've said for over a year now, Hillary Clinton is a terribly weak candidate. It's just one issue after another. Whether valid or not, things she does or doesn't do gives Republicans ammunition all the time. And so, again, you've got the cable networks breathlessly trying to call the election now. 9 weeks is a long, long time. And it's going to, as Tim said, it would be surprising if it didn't tighten quite a bit.
Join our conversation as we endeavor to pick apart the political landscape as of recent days with Tim Hagel, Dennis Goldford, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, Dennis Goldford of Drake University. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's go to Jim. Jim calling from Dubuque. Hi, Jim. What do you have to pitch in or ask about?
Well, I've got an off-the-wall question, and I was thinking about the election in 1960. JFK won the election, And then one Sunday, about 3 or 4 weeks before he was going to take the oath of office, some guy who desperately did not want a Catholic in office almost killed him with a bomb. The Secret Service found out about it just at the last minute and defused the situation. But it would have raised the issue. He had been elected president but not sworn in. And who would become the president? I'm wondering if that question has ever been resolved so that if either our candidate, I don't know, slips on a bar of soap or gets hit by a bus, whatever.
All right.
And both before the election and after the election, but before they've taken the oath of office.
We got it, Jim. We dearly hope that's not the case, of course.
Oh, yeah.
What if, Dennis, Tim, any answers to that question?
I don't have the text in front of me, but take a look at the 20th Amendment. And if it's not the 20th, it's the 25th. But I'm pretty sure it's the 20th Amendment that changed the date of the president's inauguration from March to what we now know is January 20th. There is a section that deals with the question, and again, I can't remember the text. It provides for what happens if the president dies before he takes office.
Okay. Rob in Iowa City writing us this email. Republicans are holding up Zika funding by tying it to limited Planned Parenthood funding. Will cause them when Zika will cause them harm, I guess, is what Rob means. With Zika, it inevitably spreads throughout the U.S. because we failed to fund the necessary research. Rob asking, how will they square those actions with Iowans as they campaign for re-election? I guess it's a matter of debate about Zika research funding, Tim Hagel.
Well, yeah, here's a good example of who gets the blame for something like this. Because, of course, Republicans are saying, look, it's the Democrats that have held this up in the Senate for the last couple of times. Hopefully they won't do so again. But as the person indicated, and as Democrats will be happy to point out, that the reason that they are holding it up has to do with the other things that are part of this bill. And you often have that, where you have a bill to do some good thing, but then the party in power will attach some amendments to it that the minority party doesn't like, and then that holds up funding. And then the question is, who does a better job of selling the message as to who's at fault as to why this good thing doesn't get passed? And so that's where we're at right now. It seems that the Zika side of things is getting more of the emphasis than the amendments that the Democrats are objecting to, but that can change. And again, that's how you message that sort of stalemate on the part of the Senate.
But Dennis, the 20th Amendment was exactly right. We did a little research here to the earlier caller. The question was whether if a president is incapacitated as president-elect or right before from the 20th Amendment, quoting from it, if at the time fixed for the beginning of the term of the president-elect shall have died, the vice president-elect shall become president. If a president shall not have been chosen before the time fixed for the beginning of his term, or if the president-elect shall have failed to qualify, then the vice president-elect shall act as president until a president shall have qualified, and the Congress may by law provide for the case wherein neither a president-elect nor a vice president-elect shall have qualified. Well, a lot of legalese, is that what we call that?
that creates employment for constitutional lawyers.
Yeah. We are fighting my way a little bit through that. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk a little bit about the conservative Fox News network in turmoil. Yesterday we found out Fox News will pay $20 million to settle a sexual harassment lawsuit by former anchor Gretchen Carlson. Company also settling with two other women who were part of a Fox-initiated investigation. During that investigation, more than two dozen women described harassment by Roger Ailes. 21st Century Fox offered a public apology, which is, I guess, unusual in this case, a public apology to Carlson, who filed a lawsuit against Ailes in July, saying he took her off a popular show, cut her pay because she refused to have a sexual relationship with him. Fox News announced yesterday, that Greta Van Susteren, 14 years as host of On the Record, leaving the network. Roger Ailes has a political background, former political consultant who founded the conservative news operation in 1996. He left less than 3 weeks after Carlson filed that suit, taking with him a $40 million severance package. So, Dennis, what does the turmoil in Fox mean when we see it through a political lens? And given the history of Fox News, over the past two decades in this country.
Well, liberals are going to chuckle and say, told you so, and be very happy, schadenfreude, and all that. But I think unless you believe, and I'm not making this claim, unless you believe that conservatives tend to be more prone towards sexual harassment and sexism than non-conservatives of any sort, some people may want to make that claim, but I don't think it's valid. There's nothing inherently connecting that turmoil with Fox's role as the place for conservative politics, to tweak the MSNBC phrase. You know, for the longest time, there was this view that there is a kind of consensus liberal framework that governed the country, and with the view that, in fact, that this was fairly neutral and it provided the terms under which we all play, you know, like the rules of baseball or football. They don't favor one side or the other. And William F. Buckley, with the creation of the conservative movement, began to argue, both in print and in broadcast, that no, this apparent consensus had a liberal bias to it, and they believed that they were fighting back. Not that Buckley had anything to do with Fox, but they believed they were fighting back by creating, even though they called it fair and balanced, by creating a network that represented a point of view they believed had been smothered by the reigning consensus.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Dennis, I want to ask Tim this as well. Has Fox News, having been around now for, 20 years, has its influence been significant or decisive in recent elections, do you think, Dennis?
It's given conservatives a place to go. I mean, Pew Research data about viewership and audiences in the media find that liberals tend not to have a particular go-to place. They go to various outlets, and of course conservatives would respond that all those outlets are liberal anyway, so it doesn't matter. But conservatives go overwhelmingly to Fox. What's occurred over the past several years is an increasing criticism of Fox, not just by liberals, but by conservatives themselves, because Fox has helped to create what's sometimes called this bubble, academically epistemic closure, in which people don't hear points of view outside of that bubble. And conservative writers like Michael Gerson just in the past week have argued that this distorts conservatives' view of the real world, and they become totally incapable of understanding that they're preaching to the choir, but there are a lot more people out there that don't share those views.
It's a pretty big choir you're preaching to. It is the largest news cable network out there, but
it's still significantly smaller than the average audience you'd have for a broadcast news program, NBC, ABC, CBS, mm-hmm. even now.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, how do you see it?
Well, we've seen those kinds of criticisms of Fox. I think to a certain extent, even though Fox is a single entity, as Dennis was sort of hinting at, that a lot of the people think that, well, look, if you're talking, again, focusing even just on the cable, CNN and MSNBC, but even when you broaden that out to NBC, ABC, and CBS, that, look, they're all liberal outlets. And so if that's true, and to the extent that liberals can go to one to the other, to a certain extent, there's a bubble there, too, although you should have some variation given that you've got five different outlets, and so they're not all going to be exactly the same. There's also been criticism from, as Dennis was saying, from the Republican side of things, but some of the recent criticism is that Fox News is too liberal, that they're complaining that they're too establishment and so forth. And so it's interesting that Fox is getting this criticism from being both too liberal and too conservative, which sometimes you might say, well, then maybe they're getting it right.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also a question, they're giving a lot of airtime to Donald Trump. According to Media Matters, that organization, in July, they tracked Fox News and aired it. They aired more than 2 hours of interviews with Trump during July. That was more than all other outlets combined. And it's been noted that Trump and his advisors have changed the candidate's strategy towards media appearances, largely turning down requests on outlets other than Fox News. But some would also disagree with the idea that Trump is a conservative.
Yeah, and you know, along those lines, I looked at those numbers, and assuming that they're true, and I have no reason to believe that they're not in terms of just the amount of airtime, that there are a couple of reasons for that have to do with, in particular, the primary contests, that you had a lot of time where Trump was focusing on the media for his primary victories until he got the nomination. You had ultimately a fairly competitive race for the Democrats with Clinton and Sanders, but it wasn't just getting that much attention that it didn't draw the viewers. And so that's why you had so much more attention early on. Even now you're seeing that Trump, to the extent you've got that change in sort of strategy on his part, Fox is going to be perhaps a friendlier outlet. That one of the things that you're seeing and that the Trump people complain about is that the media has turned on him to a certain extent. And many conservatives that don't support Trump were afraid of exactly that, that the places are giving him Trump a lot of time in the primaries because it would help to embarrass Republicans generally. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden he gets the nomination and they're turning their back on
him. Okay, we're coming on a break. Dennis, you get in here
yeah.
as well with your thoughts.
But Trump doesn't even have to go on a friendly network, and nobody's been friendlier to him than Sean Hannity, evidently. But to benefit, because even if he's deals with more critical reporters on other networks, that just confirms the impression of a lot of conservatives that there's media bias. But to a great extent, even if he's not showing up on CNN, you know, as I put it to a CNN guy right after the caucuses, I'll clean this up. But I said, you know, if Trump scratches his rear end, you guys give him an hour and a half coverage. And the guy sort of hung his head and said, I know. So while Trump may not talk to CNN now, CNN helped make Trump beyond the Fox audience.
Mm-hmm. And we have to differentiate within Fox. Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity is not a Megyn Kelly. Trump
right.
had the dust up with Megyn Kelly and the famous quote about blood coming out of whatever.
Whatever.
Right. So it's interesting. So very quickly before we go to break, does this mark a turning point for Fox? You said perhaps Tim Hagel. Do you think so, Dennis?
Some people are saying let's wait till after the election and see if there's any kind of shakeup at that point. We may not know until then.
Mm-hmm. Fox primarily interested in making money, so they chose this underserved audience. Is that the theory we're going with? Conservative voters from the outset, Roger Ailes' idea here?
Well, I think in large part that's true. I mean, they're in it to make money, not necessarily to espouse a particular viewpoint. But what they saw was perhaps a combination of things where you've got the conservative views that aren't being represented, which also then represents a market share.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll be back in just a moment with more of our Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. When we come back, we'll talk about Labor Day issues, how each of the candidates, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, have made stops, how they are approaching organized labor, trying to get out the union vote. Also, we'll look at the latest polls and try to make sense of them. There was a CNN ORC poll that put Donald Trump in a national head-to-head race with Hillary Clinton ahead. We'll get our analysts' thoughts on that as well. Also, the role surrogates are playing in this campaign. We want to invite you to join our conversation with Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. What's on your mind? 61 days away from the general election, 1-866-780-9100. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a Politics Wednesday edition with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, picking apart politics 61 days before the general election, or as Tim Hagel mentioned to me in the break, 62 days away from the beginning of the, wait for it, 2020 election cycle. Tim, you have a basis for that?
Yeah, as I was telling my students yesterday, the first call I got from a reporter regarding the 2016 election and caucuses was the day after the 2012 general election.
Oh, Dennis. Oh, my goodness. Okay. We want to reach out to you this hour. Ask if you have any questions on any of the topics we're talking about this election. 1-866-780-9100. Labor Day, traditionally the start of the last leg of the campaign season, both campaigns on Monday making a pitch to working class voters, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton making stops in Ohio, a state whose voters are critical to any presidential candidate. Like Ohio, Iowa is a swing state, but we only have 6 electoral votes. Ohio has 18 electoral votes. Campaigning in Ohio and in the Quad Cities this weekend, Hillary Clinton voiced support for working families and unions.
Unions not only raise incomes and provide benefits for union members, but because of unions, everybody is better off. And that's a message I'm going to talk about every single day in this campaign.
Donald Trump also spent time in Ohio pushing a message of job creation and criticizing trade deals, specifically the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is the greatest danger yet. The TPP, as it's known, would be the death blow for American manufacturing. It would give up all of our economic leverage to an international commission that would put the interests of foreign countries above our own.
Okay, Donald Trump and his challenger, Hillary Clinton. Dennis, how did you hear each of the candidates courting the union vote here?
Well, you have to remember that the union vote is actually not that large. Roughly speaking, right now, 11% of the American workforce is unionized compared to 20% in 1983. And even of that 11%, if you look at the private sector, only 6.7% of private sector workers are in unions, whereas 35% of public sector workers are unions. So Republicans like to rail against union bosses, just as Democrats talk about millionaires and billionaires and so forth. But it's really a relatively small group. But I believe I saw the Teamsters, who have oftentimes endorsed since Nixon Republicans, they've endorsed Hillary Clinton. But the big problem for Democrats, and they've always had union support, is whether the union workers, the rank and file, will follow the recommendations of union leaders. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Trump is after those union workers as well as the rest of the so-called blue-collar or working-class workforce.
And of course, Trump's key demographic is white men who are not college-educated. Some of those would, of course, be in union jobs. Tim Hagel Clinton worried that Trump will peel off some of this organized labor in significant numbers?
I think that's probably true, although, as Dennis was pointing out, the percentages are not that big. But that's also why Trump focuses perhaps more on jobs, where you heard Hillary Clinton specifically talk about unions and the value of unions and how unions have helped people that even aren't in unions for a variety of reasons, whereas Trump focuses on jobs and so forth. But let me also say that another reason that unions are important, and perhaps more important than their numbers would suggest, is the extent to which that they will get out and help turn out the vote, not just for union members, but for others as well. So if you've got people that are out there making phone calls, knocking on doors, doing whatever's necessary to help that turnout effort, that can be very important for the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the recent polls. We had this CNN ORC poll come out in the early part of the week showing Trump ahead of Clinton in a national poll, and we've talked about it many times in this setting, that our presidents are not elected by a national popular vote. They're elected by this thing we call the Electoral College. That's why we focus in on the state races, the swing state races. But it was said that there were 43% to 45% in favor of Trump. How do you interpret this poll or any other recent polls, Dennis, that you've seen?
Well, first of all, supposedly Chuck Todd did some work and decided that this particular poll oversampled the non-college-educated white working class voters. And so if you work out to see their proportion in the electorate in 2012, and it's the declining proportion, it showed Clinton ahead. So there was some question about whether they had a good, accurate sample, representative sample. But nonetheless, we get these folks, and even on yesterday in CNN, a reporter touting this proposal, and then just as you said correctly, Ben, but of course we don't elect our voters this way, then why are you hyping this other than just to hype your own network? So this I'm sorry about the rant, but yeah, exactly. We pick our presidents on a state-by-state basis. If you think of a baseball, if you think of the World Series, how do you determine who wins the World Series? You could decide to add up who has more runs than the other side, or you can decide who wins more games, 4 out of 7. Well, the Electoral College is like counting games. When you talk about these national polls or the popular vote, that's like counting total runs. It doesn't matter. It's who wins more games.
Interesting. Anything on that point, Tim, on polling and what to pay attention to? Ranting perfectly allowed on this program.
I'll skip the World Series analogy, but I would be happy to join in rants about polls because I think that they do get overemphasized, even aside from the fact of trying to distinguish between national polls versus the state-by-state polls. And national polls are fine when we are very early in the season, perhaps maybe less so when you're trying to determine who's going to win a particular primary or caucus in a state. But now that we're within 9 weeks of it, we should be focusing a little bit more on the states. But the national polls do give a certain mood for it. And to the extent that Chuck tried to adjust the polls, a number of Republicans and conservatives had a field day with that, talking about how that they were skewing the polls and trying to unskew it and all of this. And so a lot of the complaints that people, Republicans, came under for criticizing the polls in the lead-up to the 2012 election, saying that they weren't representative and so forth, and now all of a sudden you've got the same thing going the other direction. But the point of a lot of this is that you still don't know, even 9 weeks out, who's actually going to turn out. Well,
exactly.
Yes, maybe the current poll, whatever it is, whatever it's that one or some other one, that they pick some particular sample to choose by. We don't know. And given that we've got two candidates that are so unlikable by a large number of people, you don't know the extent that the base is going to turn out, plus the no party voters, the independents. What's going to happen to them? Are they going to turn out? Are they going to turn out in the same numbers? And right now, you have less enthusiasm on the part of a lot of Democrats than you do on Republicans.
Okay. Let me just remind historically, in 1980, by the Friday before the election, most people believe and pollsters believe that Ronald Reagan would beat Jimmy Carter in a close race. They stopped polling on the Friday. Well, Reagan beat Carter with 50.1% of the vote to about 41% of the vote, Electoral College landslide. All sorts of people decided over the weekend after they had stopped polling that they were going to go for Reagan. The polls didn't pick that up. So Tim's exactly right. We know who likely voters are, but there's still a question of who becomes an actual voter.
Let's go to Lori in Columbus Junction. She dialed 1-866-780-9100 on Politics Wednesday with Tim Hagel and Dennis Goldford. Lori, what's on your mind?
Well, I just kind of feel that neither party has gotten the message that people are disgusted with the corruption and the lies and the greed in Washington. That's why Trump got the nomination. It's not that people particularly adore him or anything. It's just because we're sick of the status quo and we want something different.
Mm-hmm. So may I ask, Lori, where your support will be, or do you know yet?
For Johnson.
Gary Johnson, a Libertarian candidate.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How did you land?
Yeah.
How did you land there?
Well, I think Hillary Clinton is a liar, and I think Donald Trump is a little bit unbalanced, and I guess Johnson is it.
Okay.
You know?
Lori, thank you from Columbus Junction. It gives us an opportunity to talk about how third-party candidates, Gary Johnson, Libertarian, Jill Stein, Green Party, how are they shaping this race as you see it, Dennis?
Well, we always talk about third-party candidates, and as we get closer to the election, their polling numbers right now, when we look how it actually comes out in the wash, their turnout or their vote will probably be much less as people decide they're not going to spend that vote that way. But again, the question is who polls from where? I mean, the assumption is that Jill Stein and the Green Party, just as Ralph Nader polled from Al Gore, they would poll from Hillary Clinton, P-U-L-L, not P-O-L-L. And Gary Johnson seems to have some attraction to both Sandinistas and Republicans who are more libertarian because the want a smaller government and cut down on entitlements and so forth, because Trump is not in favor of that. His supporters are more populist. They want entitlements. They want protectionism, all these things that go against Republican orthodoxy. But, again, I think as we get closer, in a tight race, everything matters. People were worried in 1968 that George Wallace would tilt the election to the electoral to the House, because Wallace did get 13.5% of the vote, and he did win, what was it, Tim, 45, 46 electoral votes, something like that.
Something like that.
Whereas Ross Perot in 1992 got 19% of the electoral vote, but he didn't win a single states. Republicans like to think that Perot tipped the election to Clinton away from Bush, but studies show that Perot voters would have split fairly evenly between Bush and Clinton, so he didn't really tilt the race to Clinton over Bush.
If I'm interpreting, reading between the lines and what you said there, Dennis, too, is that if it's perceived to be a very close election, some of these third-party people will go to their second choice in the major party, and if it's deemed to be a blowout, they'll vote as a protest vote for a third party?
Yeah, they might. Well, I mean, Democrats have been trying to remind the Democratic base, remember Ralph Nader. So, yeah, if you feel it's a blowout, going to be a blowout on one side or the other, you tend to feel it doesn't really matter. You can give the protest. If it is tighter, you may think, well, my vote really will matter more. And you might say, I don't like either, but one's not as bad as the other.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about surrogates quickly. A flood of well-known Democrats hitting the campaign trail to bolster Hillary Clinton. She has many more surrogates than Donald Trump at hand. Michelle Obama, Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, former President Bill Clinton, of course, current President Barack Obama, other high-profile people. Meanwhile, yesterday, Donald Trump's campaign released a letter signed by 88 retired military leaders endorsing his presidential candidacy. Tim Hagel, how much do surrogates matter?
Well, let me back up a second, because what I usually talk about or what people ask about are endorsements. And you mentioned the military folks that endorse Trump. Well, that's fine. But the key to an effective endorsement is usually the extent to which that person is actually going to get out and help the particular candidate. And that's mm-hmm. where you get in, where you talk about surrogates. If somebody's going to show up at an event, have a bunch of people, and talk on behalf of that candidate to lay out the vision and so forth. And Trump, of course, is running the non-traditional campaign. He hasn't doing that. So the message is his, and to the extent that he's relying on the media, that's fine. Although you do like to have these events where people will come, and you can have your campaign workers get them signed up, ask them questions, get them to commit to your candidate. And that's where the surrogates and showing up at these various events can be very important. And there's Trump out there on the campaign trail to the extent he's doing this. And Pence, of course, is doing it. You may have a few others. Giuliani has said that he would be willing to do it if he's asked. But it is helpful, especially for when the Democrats approach, when you're trying to get Sanders convincing his supporters to come over to Clinton or to Clinton's side. And same thing with Elizabeth Warren, who's been a darling of the progressive left as well, or that's how it's usually characterized. If she can say that, yes, Hillary Clinton is the one, she's qualified, she needs to be our next president, that it can bring those people that are maybe not overly enthusiastic about Clinton on board. And so far, Democrats have done a better job of consolidating their base than Republicans have.
Let's go to Brad in Cedar Rapids. Brad joining our Politics Wednesday edition with Tim Hagel and Dennis Goldford. Coming to the end of the hour, I'll ask you to make it brief, but what's on your mind, Brad?
Well, I'm interested because as the Republican Party put Trump forward as the nominee, it started to look like there was going to be a schism. And a lot of the contortion acts that have been going on about we support but we don't endorse, or we endorse but we don't support, mm-hmm. have been largely successful. So they have so far avoided that schism. But if Trump gets the election, or even if he doesn't going forward, I wonder what kind of effect we would see, whether they're going to hold the whole thing together.
Mm, excellent question, Brad. So what happened to that schism, Dennis Goldford, and going forward, we had a split in the Republican Party portended at one point, didn't we?
Well, we've had rumors of the death of the Republican Party ever since Obama won in 2008, and I think they're vastly exaggerated. But there is a division, because the Republican establishment has discovered that the Republican base really isn't Republican because they like standard Republican orthodox positions like cutting back entitlements, shrinking government, lower taxes, and free trade and all that. That's not where the base is. The elites have been very stunned to find that out. You do have a significant number at the establishment elite level who will not vote for Trump, whether or not they vote for Clinton. But you've got just, an angry group of people, particularly white working class folks, that is people who are defined as income less than $50,000 a year and do not have a four-year college degree. They're the ones who've had a difficult time, particularly economically, but the focus has not been really so much economic as cultural, this sense of I want my country back. That's really where that energy is. And I think that If Trump wins, the Republican elites, a lot of them think we can use Congress to tame and control him. That's McConnell, Senator McConnell's argument. I don't know if that's workable or not. Others think that he could damage, in their view, damage and tarnish the Republican reputation, the Republican brand. I mean, if Trump loses narrowly, then there really will be all-out civil war in the Republican Party, feeling that those Republicans that don't like Trump cost them the election. If Trump just gets creamed electorally and to some extent popular vote, then the Republican powers that be will use that as their warrant to come back and claim control of the party.
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, do you see it the same way or differently?
In many respects, I do, particularly the idea that if it's a close race but Trump loses, that you'll see lots and lots of finger-pointing. And although I've seen some on the conservative side saying, look, we disagree with Trump, but we agree on lots of other stuff, and basically saying, well, let's come together after the election regardless of the outcome. But I'm not sure that's going to happen because some of the feelings are, as you can imagine, pretty intense. And I'm not talking about sort of the trolls kinds of thing. I'm talking even among the pundits and the people in the popular conservative movement that have vastly different views on whether Trump is qualified and so forth. And a number of people are still in that never Trump camp. But I think also that it's, even though you see that a number of people that support Trump are very aggressive in how they do so, what's missed is, as Dennis was kind of hinting at this, people that are sort of out there, the average working person that's looking to say, look, you know, I think my country has some serious problems here, and a lot of them are caused by elites that don't pay attention of whatever party, and just, they, like Dennis said, they want their country back in some sense. And not necessarily in some negative way, but just have this feeling that the country is at this critical moment and they want something different. And so that's why they've picked Trump. But we have to see, both in terms of the ultimate outcome of the election, but also in terms of how much the vote goes one way or the other as to what's going to happen. And if Trump wins, I think that probably he can figure out some way to get along with Congress, although probably not the extent that Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan would like.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, in a nutshell, is that Democrats want the 1960s back, and Republicans want the 1950s back. But we're in the 2010s, and neither party has told us how we navigate this new decade.
Interesting way to see it, Dennis. Before we go, we talked about the national poll, the meaning or the meaninglessness of a national polls. But let's talk about states. I want to hear quickly from each of you. How is the electoral map shaping up? What are the key states? We have to, well, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump both in Ohio. Ohio has to be front and center here. If you win Ohio, do you win the election based on what we know? Tim?
Yeah, that's the one that everybody says at this point, that Republicans have never won the White House without winning Ohio, and certainly that's important. Now, of course, there are other swing states, too. You can't just focus on that one state, but just in terms of sort of the ultimate shift, that seems to say that the country has shifted so far to the left that Ohio goes for the Democrat, then the Republicans really don't have much of a chance. But they're going to focus on other places like Pennsylvania and Florida, Virginia, and even Iowa, though, again, as you mentioned earlier, we don't have a lot of electoral votes, so we may not get that much attention.
Mm-hmm. How do you see that electoral map shaping up, Dennis?
Well, I think it's still the case that 17 states plus Washington, D.C. have voted Democratic in every one of the last six presidential elections. Right now, they total 242 electoral votes. If Hillary Clinton holds those, which is why Trump wants to go after Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, for example, if the Democrats hold every one of those and get Florida, it's over. She's got 271 electoral votes. Ohio doesn't matter. North Carolina doesn't matter. Virginia doesn't matter. Iowa doesn't matter. She can still lose this. I'd rather have her numbers going in right now than his, but she can still lose this.
Mm-hmm. She can still lose this, and of course we have, as is always the case, we have the unforeseen events that pop up.
Right.
And Dennis, I'm going to give you a minute now to tell us what those events are.
I can see the unforeseen. That's what you want me to do. By definition, you can't see the unforeseen. No, if there is, you know, some people have argued that Trump appeals to the father figure, I will protect you. You know, his message at the convention was be afraid, be very afraid, and only I can save you, and so forth. If some awful foreign policy or especially domestic terrorism event occurs and trips people's fear trigger, which is always really powerful, that certainly can help him. If there's some sort of economic crisis all of a sudden, or if that can certainly help him, because again, we're in the 3-year itch, you know, the 3-term itch. We don't really send a party back for a third term, so Clinton's going against that. But she's lucky in that her opponent is Donald Trump, just as Donald Trump is lucky that his opponent is Hillary Clinton.
All right, well, that's it there. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science and Flansburgh Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. Thanks for coming into the studio today, Dennis.
Always a pleasure.
Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Tim, thank you for coming in.
Welcome.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon. Also help today from John Pemble. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.